Are we ready? We have a gentleman here to speak with us, share with us tonight. Jerry from Oceanside. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Glad you're here with us.
My name is Jerry and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
My sobriety date is June 18, 2018. I just took 6 years a couple weeks ago. John, thanks for asking me to come down. It's good to see that AA down in South Bay, down in Chula Vista, is alive and well. Welcome to the newcomers, to those men and women who announced themselves as new and those who didn't. I hope your life is pretty crappy. I hope you're in a lot of pain, and I hope you're out of good ideas. If that's the case, then welcome. That was the price I had to pay for admission into AA. Congratulations to the people that took time. Xavier, you got a cool token. That token's been in existence for over 4 decades. And the X-Man, where you at, buddy? Congratulations on 10 years. And Mary, happy birthday. You know, it's funny. I was told to wear something decent to come down here, and I had a pair of slacks on and a green Dickies button down. But as I was walking out the house, my mom looked down from heaven, and she's like, "You're not going out the house like that." So I said, "Even from the grave, I listen to my mom." And so I put on a pair of slacks and a shirt that I don't like, and some dress shoes I don't like, and sprayed some cologne on, and put some water on my face. But what it was like for me, I was born in Virginia. I'm the oldest of 5 kids, and my life was pretty vanilla, you know. 2 brothers, 2 sisters, and a baby cousin that lived with us. And you know, Dad worked at a sawmill, and Mom, she was a veterinary technician. But my parents wanted more for us. For the kids that they had. You know, Mom and Dad had a rough growing up in the 50s and the 60s. They just wanted a better life for their kids. So there's no kind of extracurricular BS. You know, there's Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and sports, football, baseball, 4-H. I was part of a large extended family with a lot of cousins and uncles and aunts and great uncles and aunts. I was fortunate to know 2 sets of great grandparents on both sides. And everything was nice and pleasant. My mom and dad didn't drink. I really wasn't exposed to that as a kid. You know, I hear stories all the time about how, you know, I sponsor a couple guys. Oh, by the way, my home group is the Sunday night men's, Liebenhine Sunday night men's called The Barn up in Encinitas. I have a sponsor for 21 years, and I sponsor a couple guys in North County. In South Orange County and San Diego. I do that because that was told to me when I came into AA. I had to find a sponsor, and I had to have a home group, and I had to sponsor guys. But getting back to the family, so, you know, I was never really exposed to any kind of alcoholism growing up. I had a couple great uncles that smelled like cheap, you know, rum and cheap liquor. They used to walk around and khaki pants with piss stains on them, and you know, they didn't shave. My dad called them winos, called them drunks, you know. They were cool growing up, seeing them kind of act the way they do. But anyway, there was no drinking or anything like that in my family. You know, we had to fit a mold. We had to be a certain type of way. There's no kind of cussing or listening to weird music. It was just kind of like a Bible Belt kind of growing up in the South. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, I used to go to my great-grandma's house, and she lived out in the country in an old log cabin that had been in the family for over 100 years. And as a kid, I used to sit on the hillside at night in Virginia and underneath an apple tree, and I would stare out into when it was about 7:30, 8 o'clock, I would stare out into the cornfield. And I could hear the owls in the back. I could hear the millions of bullfrogs down at the bottom of the creek. I could smell this. There was a smell of honeysuckle and lilac and rose and the smell of the woods. I would hear these little whippoorwills in the back going to sleep for the night. As I crossed over, as I looked over the field, I could see a million fireflies in the edge of the woods. I looked up, and there were trillions of stars and this brightest moon. And I would lay there as a kid, 5 and 6 years old, and that's where God revealed himself to me for the first time as a kid. I can still feel that. This was a person, a power that I didn't have a name for. There was no face, no shape. He was my best friend. And I used to sit there for hours and just listen to his creation. When I was about 6 or 7, my parents bought this huge piece of land in Virginia. And there was a huge creek. It was about 150 acres. And there was a huge creek that ran in the middle of it. I would go down to this little glen, this little cove, and sit on this rock in the middle of the creek and just listen to the water. God revealed himself to me then again. But then I started going to church. And religion got in God's way. Wearing shoes like this and wearing shirts like this with clip-on ties. It was hot. It was a bunch of old people with fans. And they talked about some brown-skinned, woolly-haired man that was on the wall. And religion made my best friend disappear. They told me that that brown-skinned, woolly-haired, nappy-haired man on the wall was God. But it wasn't the God that I was introduced to when I was 5 or 6 years old. So God started to get smaller and smaller and smaller for me. My dad, like in 1982, 83, was on his way to work. And anybody that lives back east, down south, knows what black ice is. He was on his way to work, and he hit a patch of black ice and wrapped his truck around a tree. And he lived, but our family suffered because of that. My baby brother had just been born, so there were 5 of us in the house. They just bought this land and all this stuff. They had gotten that piece of that American dream. I remember at 10 years old, 11 years old, on my knees outside, and I prayed to God to save my family, to save that house, and to save that land. And he didn't. And God didn't do what I wanted him to do, so I turned that light off. Now, being a little bit Southern Baptist, a little bit Jehovah's Witness, there was a lot of religion for me in my early teen years. I was going to church on Sundays, going to church on Wednesdays, going to church on Fridays, going to church on Saturdays, going for Easter and potlucks and cookouts and funerals and weddings, and it was just too much work. Now, again, my parents, my family, they wanted more for us. So, you know, when I got into, after that car wreck, my family moved from this nice urban setting where people look like me. We moved into the suburbs with a bunch of people that didn't look like me. And that's where my alcoholism started, that spiritual malady, that feeling of not being a part of. I was lost, you know, hanging out with a bunch of people that didn't listen to the same type of music. They didn't dress like me. They didn't talk like me. They weren't me. And I tried so hard to be a part of. I assimilated into a way of living that I just wanted to be accepted. But the people that didn't look like me never accepted me for who I was. And in the process of trying to assimilate into something that I thought you guys wanted, I lost connection with where I came from. So I straddled two worlds, looking like I do, hanging out in the world that didn't look like me, but the people that looked like me didn't want to be with me anymore. So my disease continued to grow. So there's no drinking or any kind of extracurricular activities. I know this is an AA meeting. That's a part of my story. Got into college, and I was introduced to Sigma Phi Epsilon fraternity. Sigma, frat parties. 3 hours away from home, and for the first time, all that fear and all that uncomfortable disconnect went away. I was a blackout drinker from jump. Drinking allowed me to fit in. I actually found the solution to my problem, and it was alcohol, and I liked it. I was blackout drinking Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, sometimes Sundays. My fraternity allowed me to drink the way I wanted to. Like Bill Wilson, I had acquired the impeccable coat of Sigma Phi Epsilon. You know, I had arrived. I was fun to carry them around the college fraternity. I used to dream about this when I was in high school. I finally got there. Little did I know that when I was 18 years old, that summer of 1989, I commenced to forge a weapon that would almost take me out. But that boomerang took a long time to come back. For you guys that read the book, it's in there. How I graduated college with a 3.1, I'm still curious, you know, I don't ask how I did it. I just know I have the diploma at my parents' house. So when I got out of college, I took a job as a sports editor for a newspaper in Virginia. And again, it was kind of like a continuation of college. You know, I was hanging out with a bunch of sports directors and athletic directors and coaches and staff and a bunch of young men my age. It was kind of like a continuation of the frat party, you know. And, you know, it was fun. You know, I'm 23, 24 years old, and things weren't bad. You know, I was drinking and doing other things, but I was going to work and wasn't causing too much wreckage. It was fun. Little did I know that I have a disease called alcoholism. My disease is progressive, but it took a long time for that thing to progress. About a year into my job, it was the week of Christmas, and I came to work. I was still drunk, a little bit hungover. I wasn't really feeling good. And I worked with a bunch of women. I was the only, you know, sports editor. I was the only guy that worked there. Now, so I had my own bathroom, and which is awesome. And they had their bathroom. Well, one day I just wasn't feeling good, and I went into the restroom. I was sitting in the stall, and I heard this click clack come in the bathroom. And I looked down, and I said, I heard my boss's name was Betty. I'm like, Betty, what are you doing in here? What are you doing in the men's room? And she goes, Jerry, you're in the women's room. I didn't make it after that. So one of my best friends in college had come to San Diego. He lived down in Mission Beach. And I had this idea, I wanted to go to California. So in the summer of 1994, I decided to come out west. And I moved to Mission Beach, where all young practicing alcoholics in training go live. I lived about 3 or 4 blocks north of Belmont Park on one of the courts on the ocean side. And again, it was fun. You know, I was living my life. I was about 23, 24 years old. But we had 3 rules in our house. The first rule was there's no not drinking. There's no showering. And there's no sleeping. And I was like, okay, I can do that. I owned a business in PB. I had a sales office there. And I actually would contract with another larger sales office, and it allowed me to travel all over the country. I picked a career. I picked a job that would allow me to go to different cities for 3 or 4 months and burn it down and just leave. I worked in Phoenix. I worked in Albuquerque. I was in Dallas. I was in Miami. I was in Philly. I was in Allentown. I was in Williamsport. I was in Baltimore. I was in York, PA, Scranton, New Bedford, Mass., Jersey City, New Jersey, Hartford, Connecticut, Virginia Beach, Virginia twice, Raleigh, North Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina. And I did that for a long time. I could go to a town, I could go to a city, go raise hell and cause all this wreckage, and after 3 or 4 months, I'm out. I got to the point where I was just kind of done traveling, you know, so I went back to the East Coast for a while. Then I ended up in Florida. I lived in Florida. Now, Florida was kind of like a cool place to live for me. It's a combination of California and Virginia. You know, you had the palm trees and the good weather and that southern charm. But Florida, again, fueled my alcoholism even more. It was in 2017. I'm going to fast forward to 2017. A hurricane was, we used to have hurricane parties in Florida. If you guys don't know what that is, you drink and you watch the hurricane come in. You got a bunch of ice and food and propane for the grill, and make sure your car is full, and you get a whole lot of alcohol, and you just, you know, go swimming in the canals and hang out and just, yeah, it's that, yeah. So there was a hurricane coming in 2017. It was supposed to hit on the east coast of Florida, Panama City, on Daytona Beach, Miami, West Palm Beach, that side. But for some reason, it turned in the middle of the night, and I woke up the next morning to water flowing into our living room because we lived on a canal. The canal, the storm surge had pushed the water into the backyard and into the house. The house was ruined. So I packed up, went back to Virginia, and trying to figure out what to do next. Now, I told you I had this spiritual malady. You know, I had no God in my life. But as I'm looking back, you know, as I look back over my life, I see that God was there the whole time. I was back in Virginia Beach hanging out with my ex-girlfriend, and I was at a random 7-Eleven the weekend of Labor Day weekend. And I was at the, I was getting some beer at the beer cooler, and this random dude walks up to me. He goes, "Yo, bro, you need to stay away from the oceanfront right now." And I'm like, "Why?" "Because you smell like a brewery, dude." I was like, "Whatever." So I grab my beer, and 5 minutes later, I'm pulled over by Virginia Beach City cops for a DUI. Looking back, I knew that was God right there trying to whisper in my ear to let me know that I need to go left instead of right. So I was in jail for a couple of minutes, and my girlfriend bailed me out. And I remember the day I had to go to court. I had to be at court at 8:30, but at 7:30, I was in the kitchen slamming tall boys of Bud Light. I was going to go get sentenced that morning for my DUI, and I'm drinking Bud Light. And I remember the look that she had. She's like, "Are you kidding me? What are you doing? My nerves. You know, I need something for my nerves. If I'm going to jail, I'm going to jail drunk." There's that progression right there. I could hear that boomerang. It was actually making noise. It was actually on its way back. So went to court, spent a couple weekends in jail, and then had this bright idea that, you know, kind of done with Virginia, kind of done with the East Coast. I kind of want to go back to California. Now, a year earlier than that, my mom had a stroke. She was in a hospital. She was in a nursing home. And I remember telling my dad that I was going to go back to Virginia Beach to take care of some legal stuff. But I stopped to go see my mom in the hospital, in her nursing home. My mom was 64 when she passed away. And my mom had so many unresolved, she had so many dreams that she didn't get a chance to do. She had these big plans when she and my dad had retired. I remember seeing my mom's broken body in the bed, and I just had this feeling that I don't want to be her. I don't want to come to the end of my life and have all these regrets and all these things, all these unfulfilled dreams that I had. I remember telling my mom, as I held her hand, I remember taking a picture of her, and I held her hand like this. I told her, I was like, "You know, I think I'm going to go back to California." And she just looked at me like, "Here he goes again," because I'm the nomad son, always around, always driving, always flying, always training, always busting, always driving, always doing something. I can never sit still. Little did I know that that would be the last time I saw my mom. That picture I took of her hand and my hand was the last picture I would ever take of my mama. So I came back out west. This is 2017. I was hanging out with one of my best friends in Fresno because I thought Fresno would be a cool place to go, but it's not really. Sorry for anybody from the 559 San Joaquin Valley here. So I hightailed to Fresno, but to this day I can't tell you which route I took, what cities I drove through, which hotels I stopped in. I can't tell you how I got there. Again, I look back and see that God was there. On the way to California, I was talking with one of my best friends who lived in Flagstaff, Arizona, and we'd made plans to come out to get together when I got to California. And I remember I was so wrapped up with my disease. You know, I have a disease of just me. It's selfish and it's insidious and it's evil. That's all about me. And I remember I was on the New Mexico-Arizona border, and he wanted me to stop to see him, but I just didn't make time to see him. I was like, I remember this part of my trip. I was supposed to stop in Flagstaff, but I decided to keep going to California. And I remember calling my best friend when I got to California. It was a Monday. I told him, hey, I'm here. No answer. Called him again. Hey, I'm here. Send him a couple text messages. And his wife had called me Tuesday and told me that Greg had swallowed a bullet that Sunday that I was supposed to meet him. I was so wrapped up in me that I couldn't make time to see him. It's taken me a long time to kind of give that over to God, but I have to. That boomerang is starting to make some more noise. It's in October 2017, I woke up. I was in Fresno, and I was in full-fledged alcoholism. I woke up, and I felt this weird thing in my heart. I was lightheaded. My heart was doing these weird beats, just skipping and missing beats, and I thought I was having a heart attack. So I called EMS, and they came and got me. And I got to the hospital in St. Francis Hospital in Fresno. I got there, and the doctor looked at me. He goes, I don't think you know how sick you were, Mr. Harris. Had you waited another day, you probably would have died from a cardiac arrest. I drank to the point I wasn't eating. I wasn't drinking fluids. I wasn't taking care of myself. All the good stuff that keeps heart function, like sodium and magnesium and potassium, they were at critical levels. And he asked me, he goes, do you want to detox? Do you want to stay sober? Do you want some help? And I'm like, yeah, why not? So for 8 days, I was detoxing off of alcohol and other substances, and it was the most excruciating thing I'd ever gone through. The hallucinations and the auditory things and all the things I saw that I'm still not convinced weren't real happened to me in those 8 days. I got out of the hospital. My roommate and my friends were like, you can't come back to the house. They packed my Xterra. Go back to San Diego. We don't want you here anymore. So I went back down to San Diego, the Oceanside, and I slept for 3 days. I didn't drink, but I just slept. I just slept for 3 days trying to detox on all the good stuff they gave me. And I woke up on October 29th to missed call after missed call after missed call after text message. So I picked my phone up and I called my sister. She goes, hey, brother, mom passed away today. Again, I look back and God knew what he was doing. I can promise you guys, had my mom passed away while I was in the detox, cut off from the world, I wouldn't be here today. But God saw fit to keep her around just so I can get out of there, so I can get a phone call to get back home. I flew back home to Virginia, and I was still detoxing. And to this day, my mom's funeral, I can't really remember too much of it. So I stayed sober for 2 months, the months of November and December. No meetings, no AA, no sponsor, no steps, just white knuckling. I figured, you know, I can do this on my own. Until on New Year's Eve, I was at a 7-Eleven, and I saw a sign that said on the door, two tall boys of Bud Light, two 25 ounces for $4. And I had $5 in my pocket. I've got 60 days. I got 2 months. I should be able to just drink that. It's just beer. Within a week and a half, I was right where I was that took me 25 years to get to. And it's progressive, and it's chronic, and it's fatal. That's what I have. It's called alcoholism. In the spring, I came back to California. I was like, okay, let me just go back to Cali. Maybe I didn't do it right this time. Let me go back to California one more time. So I came to Oceanside, and I was hanging out with a couple buddies I used to live with back when I was an alcoholic in training in Mission Beach. And I continued to drink. Mom was gone. My best friend's gone. I'm an alcoholic, and it's just miserable. 6 years and about 3 weeks ago, I was hanging from a bed sheet in a Motel 6 in Oceanside. Attempt number one. Attempt number two, I stood on the corner of Plaza Drive and College looking for a car. I was just going to walk out in the street. Attempt number three, I'd climb to the top of the Motel 6, and my two options were I was either going to go head first or turn around. But my best friend, he called me out of the blue because he saw some weird stuff I was putting on Facebook. And he came down, and he was going to take me to L.A. because, you know, L.A. is better, right? Says no one. So I get to Los Angeles, and he knew I was going through withdrawals. He knew I was an alcoholic. And he goes, hey, Jerry, I'll tell you what. I'll let you drink. I'll control your drinking. But you're not going to get drunk. I'm not going to watch you die. So I did that for about 3 or 4 hours. And I told him, you know what? I'm not doing this. So I grabbed my 50-pound suitcase, and I walked the streets of Los Angeles for 8 days. Who does he think he is? Doesn't he know who I think I am? It was horrible walking the streets of Los Angeles with a 50-pound bag. I was running out of money. I dared not get a hotel because that would take away from my drinking. L.A. is a good place. You know, I actually was getting comfortable with this idea that this might be the rest of my life. On day 4, I still remember this. On day 4, I was basically run out of money. And I stood in the shopping center. I saw a little old, sweet little lady. She put her purse on top of her Cadillac. And for 5, 10, 15 seconds, I was wondering, how am I going to do this? Is this actually going to happen? Am I actually going to do what I think I'm going to do? Am I going to commit a felony, an armed robbery, and burglary, and a grand theft auto on some unsuspecting little sweet old lady? That's where my disease had taken me. I was going to commit a crime. The oldest born son from a decent family in Virginia with a college education, I was about to do this on the streets of Los Angeles. But something told me not to do it. I looked back, and that was God whispering in my ear. On the sixth day, I called my dad. I was done. I was like, Dad, you know, I don't know what's going on out here. I just don't know. Virginia was always a place that I could go back to. I could go back to Virginia and just kind of reset and then go back out in the world. So I called my dad. I was like, Dad, I just want to come home. I just want to come home. And he's like, what's going on? I was like, you know, I'm on the streets. I'm drinking. I'm hanging out with weird people. And it's dark and it's dirty. And I just want to come home. He goes, all right, let me call your siblings, and we'll see if we can get you back to Virginia. Just I'll call you back. I waited there for 7 hours. Dad never called back. I'd abused that man enough, and he was done. On day number 8, I was done. I took a train out to Santa Monica. I took a train out to Santa Monica, out to a place near the 3rd Street Promenade, in a place called Cannon Park. As I stood over this cliff, there was Santa Monica Pier to the left, and Malibu to the right. I stood on this little bluff right here, and I had two options. My first option, I was going to jump off into the Pacific Coast Highway. The second option, I was going to swim out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean to a place I knew I couldn't swim back. But this third option kind of snuck up on me. I didn't even see it. As I looked out over that beach and that ocean and that sun, whatever was out there, I said two words. I actually whispered it. I said, help me. Help me. I didn't ask the God of religion. I didn't ask the God of church. I didn't ask the God that let me down. I asked for the God of my youth from 40 years prior to save my life. And he did. All of a sudden, I knew it was going to be better. I don't know what the it was, but I knew it was going to be better. 7 days after that, I went to detox back in Panama City Beach. Now, my detox, I was there for 28 days. Didn't do anything for me. I colored in the lines, and I did process group, and I did equine therapy. I went on nature hikes, and I lived with 17 other guys, and we were in the dope fiend limousine and the druggy buggy going to meetings and all this other stuff. But what it did for me, it gave me 28 days of separation from my alcoholism. Now, they told me to find a sponsor and do some AA when I came back to California. I was like, okay, yeah, whatever. Yeah, we'll do that. Just, where's my food? I need to get some smokes. I need to go to sleep. I need to get on my laptop. I wasn't really trying to do AA when I came back to California. I was just whatever you said. So I came back to California. My first men's meeting was a Rule 62 meeting in Fresno. And there, if anyone's ever been to Fresno or Clovis, you know, there's a different type of dudes up there, you know. And I walked into a meeting, and there was a bunch of people that did not look like me. I was like, here we go again. Are you kidding me? They told me to go to a meeting, and this is what I get. But I had my first spiritual experience in that meeting. It's like 50, 55 guys in there, all with long goatees and beards and long hair and Harleys and belt buckles and belt and cowboy boots and grown men. But those grown men told my life one share at a time. And I decided to stay. I found the sponsor that night. I was actually afraid to ask another man out because I was told that I had to, you know, find a sponsor. And there was a guy, his name is Joe. He had 5 years at the time. He drank like I did. He did other things like I did. He had a daughter, and he burned the world down, but he was laughing. He was happy. And he was walking out of the Rule 62 meeting, and I remember my heart was pounding in my chest. I kind of tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Joe, I don't know what I'm doing. Can you help me? And for anybody who knows me that has gotten a hug from me, they got it from my sponsor. Because my sponsor put his arms around my neck and go, and he said, yes, I got you. Call me tomorrow. I love you. What? He loves me. Doesn't he know who I am? Doesn't he know what I did out there? He didn't care what I did out there. He was just glad that I was in that meeting that night. In early sobriety, I did everything my first sponsor told me. He told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. He told me to call him every day for 90 days. I met with him once a week and read the book. If he would have told me to run down the 99 freeway naked to stay sober, he would have gotten me out of jail because I would have done it. But when I started working steps, I started to feel better. That first step, he told me I'm an alcoholic. But Joe, I do other stuff. I see a whole bunch of alcohol in there, but I don't see a whole bunch of stuff that I did. It doesn't matter if you're an alcoholic or an addict. You have a mental obsession that will convince you that your drinking and using is normal. You have a physical reaction to alcohol that once you start, you can't stop. Huh. Okay. I'm that guy. Because I'll tell you I won't drink tonight, and I mean what I say. If you hook a lie detector test up to me, the lie detector test will say that Jerry Harris is telling the truth. But the Padres just swept the Dodgers. Let's go drink. And I had this spiritual malady. And I was kind of curious about this whole spiritual thing. He goes, you're an alcoholic. Meet me next week. So we kept reading in the book. And in chapter 3, it talks about four people, actually two people, Fred and Jim, who were not convinced they're an alcoholic, much less accept spiritual principles. That's you. You're an alcoholic, but you won't find God. In Fresno, they used to say, find God or get effed. I used to hear that. I'm like, what are they talking about? But they were right. Right now, in my sobriety, in my life, God is the most important thing in my life. God is what keeps me sober, and I found God working the steps. So we continued. We did the third step, kneeled down in the desert. It was 115 degrees, but he and I held hands in the desert, and we said the third step prayer, and all of a sudden, I felt better. I decided to stay. I did the fourth step. I told my sponsor everything I swore I would not tell another man. I told that man things I swore I was going to take to the grave. And he hugged me and said he loved me. I decided to stay. We got to steps 8 and 9. I flew back home to do an amends with my dad in my first year of sobriety. I sat down with that man, the man who I abused for decades with my alcoholism. Short, sweet, scripted amends turned out to be a 7-hour conversation with my father. I saw my dad for the first time through sober eyes, and my dad got his son back, and I got my dad back because of this program. My mom, I was never able to make an amends to my mom, But my first Mother's Day weekend, my mom always wanted to go to San Francisco. That was her thing. She never got a chance to come to California. She wanted to go to San Francisco. So my first Mother's Day weekend, I was able to go to San Francisco, and I rode this big red double-decker tour bus, two-hour bus ride of the city. I had my mom's funeral card right here in my breast pocket. For 2 hours, my mom got to see the city through her sober son's eyes. And I cried the whole trip. I got over to the Golden Gate Bridge, and I remember saying, "Mom, you made it." And I wept. And I wrote my mom a letter. I wrote her an amends letter, and I put it in a bottle with a cork, and I threw it over into the harbor. For you people that know that song, "I Left My Heart in San Francisco," that means something different to me because my mom was my heart. Hopefully she's still up there floating around. And I was able to clean up some of the wreckage with my mom. Then I got to that 12 step. Now my sponsor asked me a bunch of questions. The last one was, "Are you willing to take another man through the steps and be a sponsor?" And I just said, "Yeah, whatever. I'm just, being compliant right now." But in our men's meeting, when they asked that question, he looked at me. He goes, "Why aren't you raising your hand?" "Oh, you were serious about that." My life, I had my first major spiritual awakening as the result of taking another man through the 12 steps. I was able to sit on the other side of the book and read how it works, the doctor's opinion, more about alcoholism, Bill's story, all of these chapters. And I actually was able to see this man come back to life. The man I first sponsored almost 6 years ago is still sober today. And he's continuing my lineage up there in Fresno. I never thought that I would want to come into AA and take other men through the 12 steps. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sponsees here tonight, if I count it right, maybe 5 and a half. We'll talk after the meeting. But as a sponsor, I get to see God work in these men's lives right here. I get to witness the power of God change men's lives right in front of me. I get to have these spiritual experiences as a result of these men having spiritual experiences. Again, I didn't come into AA for any of that. I came into AA as a broken down alcoholic, driven by 100 forms of fear and self-seeking and self-pity. I was angry and afraid and judgmental and dishonest and inconsiderate and selfish. I thought everybody else was the problem. I thought all you guys were the problem. She didn't love me enough. Mom didn't do this enough for me. Dad was too hard on me. My daughter, she's this way. My roommates are this way. My boss hates me. The traffic sucks. The person at 7-Eleven, he's an idiot. I was pointing fingers to everybody in the world because I thought you guys were the problem. But when I started working steps, I found the power that I called God. The 12 steps and God didn't solve all your problems, didn't solve all you guys. God solved this problem because I realized that I was the biggest problem. I like to inflict my will on other people. I like to play God in other people's lives. And then I play victim when you guys push back. I never was convinced that the 12 steps were going to work for me. I figured that you guys just sit around and complain about not drinking and complain about your wives and your husbands. You guys didn't look like me. You guys didn't talk like me. You guys didn't do the things I did. But I came in and realized that you guys are just like me. You guys speak my language, the language of recovery, the language from the big book. Language of spiritual principles in God, a language of hope. When I first came into AA 6 years ago, that group of men in Fresno, I leaned on those guys. I laid on those guys. Those guys in that fellowship brought me all the way in and told me it was okay. They told me it was okay that I was who I was, but they had a way out. One day at a time, one step at a time, one phone call at a time, one meeting at a time, I begin to recover. Let's speak to the newcomers. if you are done drinking, if you're done destroying the world around you, if you're out of good ideas, welcome. If you don't want to be here tonight, welcome. If you're on the court card, welcome. If you're here in the house, welcome. If you think you can try it one more time when you leave, welcome. I never thought that AA was going to work for me. I was convinced that I was going to hang out for a little bit, get some stuff, and just spin back out. But you guys today are my easier, softer way. You guys are my ease and comfort. You guys give me the same feeling I get when I used to take shots at the bar. You know, you guys told me that if I read the book that I can have an amazing life. Now, my life is not always amazing, but I don't have to drink over it. And that right there, if that's the only thing that AA gave me, then I'm winning. I'm winning. I get to have all these amazing things today because of AA. I have a fellowship of men around me that just love me just because I'm one of them. I get the love of my dad back. I have my siblings back. My boss likes me. He still pays me on time. I wake up and I don't have to go to the bar or find a bottle, or I don't have to scrounge money to go get. I can just wake up and just stroll into the day. I have a God of my understanding that's pretty badass. You know, he keeps me sober. You know, I do know that God is working in my life because I don't want to have to drink. I don't want to drink tonight. My buddies in North County, they were like, "Oh, why are you going all the way to Chula Vista to a meeting? Do you know what I used to do in Tijuana?" You know, I used to go down there and destroy my life. But tonight I get to go down here and save my life by just trying to carry a message that has a little bit of depth and weight. But for you newcomers, give it a shot. I'm not here to promote AA. Alcohol does the perfect job for us. I'm just here to share my story. The roads that you're going down, you newcomers, what you want to do, we've already done it. We've already been down the road you want to go to. We've paved the streets for you. We planted the trees for you. We put the benches there for you. We put the little dumpster there for you so you can go sleep behind. We've already done all the research that you want to do. But the research that's in the book right now that men over almost 100 years ago did for us, that's the way out. If you really want to stop drinking, this is the easier, softer way. If you don't want to stop drinking, just come back. I have an amazing life today. I have an amazing God today. I have a practical program of action today that tells me what to do at every moment of the day. It tells me to pause, tells me to pray, tells me to call, go to meetings, work some steps. I was explaining to one of my sponsees a little while ago that I finally get it. If you ever put together like a desk or an entertainment center or, you know, anything, it has instructions for you, right? That's my instruction manual right there. That book put me back together. I get to be a son today. I get to be a child of God today. I get to be a decent human being today. That's because of the 12 steps of AA. Thank you for having me down here. And that's all I got. Thanks.
Just tell those folks up north, you couldn't have come to a better place. We're glad to have you here and your sponsees. Okay. How about a